Good morning and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Six. We're going to have a complete wonk fest, but a couple of things first. You can subscribe to this podcast pretty much at any place, Google Play, Apple, Overcast, Spotify, Stitcher. You can also subscribe to our newsletters, which are going to remain both free and feisty. We have three newsletters every day from the Bulwark. I have the morning shots that come out early morning, and then JVL midday, and Jim Swift has overtime later in the afternoon. And there's so much going on today. This is one of those days where you feel we're kind of at that pivot point. We have the coronavirus, seems to be spreading. The president is pushing for several billion dollars. President Trump is in India. There's been an outbreak of violence in Delhi. At least 11 people killed in the last couple of days. Clashes between Hindus and Muslims. So that's going well. Meanwhile, the acting intelligence chief's paid consulting. This, of course, is Rick Grenell. Included working for a nonprofit group funded mostly by Hungary. So the swamp, but just swampier. By the way, in my newsletter today, I won't go through the whole newsletter. I start off with sort of an Orwellian discussion of the state of political language. And by Orwellian, I mean literally George Orwell, who was really, you know, obsessed with the degradation of language that accompanied the degradation of our politics. And he was obsessed with the hackification of language, the use of cliches. And I have an example from our good friends over at The Federalist, who wrote an article, "Never Trump is as dead as a doornail. This must be distinctly understood." Which, by the way, people are writing me and saying, you know, well, that was, you know, Charles Dickens, began the Christmas Carol with that cliche. But see, this is the point. Actually, go back and read what Charles Dickens wrote. He knew it was a cliche in 1843. This is the hilarious thing of this, is he began the Christmas Carol, "Old Marley was as dead as a doornail." And then he goes on basically saying he has no idea what that phrase means. He says, "Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile, and my unhallowed hands shall not disturb it, where the country's done for." Okay, so this is the point. So anyway, if you want to read that, we have a meditation on that. Also, Rush Limbaugh's reckless irresponsibility. Look, I have been really reticent to be critical of Rush Limbaugh since his diagnosis with lung cancer, and obviously, you know, want to be as sympathetic as possible. But what he did yesterday makes me wonder whether Limbaugh is saving the worst for last. He went off on this rant about the coronavirus, saying it's being weaponized to bring down Donald Trump. And then he said, look, it's being hyped. He said the coronavirus is the common cold, folks. We've got a death toll now of 2,600. This is not just a hacky rant. This is one of those things where it could have real world consequences. And I know we live in a world where everything is Trump centric. And if you are all in for Trump, you must see every possible development in the world in the context of an attack on Trump or the need to defend Trump, etc. But that was just a bizarre enough. So we have that in our newsletter this morning. Also, at the Bulwark right now, we have some... there's a lot of Bernie vetting going on right now. And it's very important stuff. And it probably is too late to make a difference. But Ben Parker has a piece that I really would strongly recommend people to read, because I do think that one of the strongest arguments that can be made for backing Bernie Sanders over Trump, by the way, I'm not making that argument, but the argument that you can hear is the fate of the rule of law, is that Donald Trump is waging this campaign against the rule of law. Just today in India, he's attacking members of the Supreme Court. But Ben actually asked an important point. Well, what about Sanders? Why do we think that Sanders is going to be fundamentally better on this issue, given the fact that, he has repeatedly and vocally supported authoritarian leaders? You know, his defense of the Sandinistas or of Maduro or of Castro certainly don't necessarily mean that Mr. Sanders is going to be the paragon of constitutionalism that we would perhaps hope. Okay, so today is, and I mentioned it's a pivotal day. We have another debate. Among the presidential candidates. And the big question is whether or not they will make the pivot from attacking Bloomberg to attacking Bernie Sanders, because we are only a few days away from the South Carolina primary and from Super Tuesday. And after Super Tuesday, this thing is probably pretty close to being over. So, let's approach this not from a policy point of view, but from a wonky number point of view. And who better to do that than our friend, David Beiler, our former colleague from the Weekly Standard, now a number crunching guru at the Washington Post. So, David, welcome back on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Charlie. It's good to be here.
Okay, so you have all kinds of stuff now. You have a piece. Who can win the Democratic primary? And because there's a lot of punditry out there, you've gone one step further than that. You've now created this simulator, an actual simulator. Explain the simulator to me.
The simulator is essentially a tool that our readers can go through, and they can play out different scenarios for the primary in different states and see what's realistic and what's not realistic. So you can go through and you can see, okay, if someone had a big fundraising surge, would that really move the needle? If somebody, you know, surged by a historically appropriate amount in the polls, would that give them a safe win and things like that? And we've got a bunch of these simulators up. We've got one for South Carolina. We've got California. We've got Texas, North Carolina, Minnesota, Massachusetts. So we've got all these things where, you know, you can sort of take the math model for a spin yourself and see what it says. And there's some pretty interesting things coming out of there, especially with respect to Sanders in I think any given one of those states, as well as in the national numbers.
Okay, I want to get to that. You basically tweeted out a little while ago some of the high level takeaways that Biden is not a lock in South Carolina. Sanders is doing way, way better in California than the conventional wisdom realizes. Warren has a couple of polls in Massachusetts, and it's not good. Klobuchar in Minnesota feels just so much like Kasich in Ohio. See, I'm having these flashbacks. And Texas, North Carolina are very, very competitive.
Yes. I mean,
that's sort of the state of play, which, you know, does indicate that this is still Bernie Sanders' race to lose.
I think that's 100% right. What we've seen with Sanders that's really interesting, so it's reflected in these state-by-state numbers that you see in the simulator, and it's also reflected in the national polls, is that essentially between January 1 and now, Sanders has gone from being a candidate who's, you know, a little under 20% to a little under 30% in the national polls. And that's caused sort of, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, right? He has gained nationally. That's helped him out in all sorts of different states. He's doing really well in California. This is kind of a undercovered story. He has a really pretty solid lead there. And he's kind of competitive in places where, if you just had to guess, where would Bernie Sanders be competitive, you know, 6 months ago, he's competitive in places where you might not have guessed. He's within spitting distance of Joe Biden in South Carolina. North Carolina as well is really close. He's got a strong following with Hispanic and Latino voters. That's helping him a lot in Texas. He really is the person to beat. And it's kind of a wild thing, because he did it without changing strategy or pivoting or anything. It's Bernie Sanders being Bernie Sanders and the rest of the field being stuck in a prisoner's dilemma.
Okay, so let's talk about this, the simulation again. So I just opened the tool so we can do this in real time.
Great.
Let's play the game. So awesome. On South Carolina, this is a volatile race. We simulated this election 10,000 times and found that even if nothing changes between now and election day, there's still a wide range of possible outcomes.
Yeah.
So 10,000 times. So what do you change which variables? Poll variables, fundraising variables?
What we do with the 10,000 different simulations is that's to capture error. So one of the goals of this whole simulator thing is to help people understand what it is that we do not know. And, you know, you look at the history of primaries, you look at how far the polls have been off in the past in 2016 and 2012 and races going all the way back to 1980. And essentially what you find in this case in South Carolina is that if Joe Biden holds up with his, you know, 3-4 point lead, that's not safe heading into Election Day. And even if Joe Biden gains some more points in the polls and has a sudden fundraising burst, let's suppose he, you know, does really well in the debate tonight and a bunch of people donate money to him. You know, I guess I'm jumping ahead a couple steps in the simulator, but that doesn't make him safe. There's still kind of a wide range of outcomes at this place and at this time. It's a race where either he or Sanders could win. But anyways, go on. Sorry.
No, I'm looking at this. So, you know, right now it would look like, you know, Biden has a small lead, Sanders in second place. And of course, this is a state where Mr. Steyer is playing the role of spoiler. I think I said this yesterday on the podcast. Of all the candidates who I can't figure out what their rationale is, other than I've got a lot of money and I've been on television a lot, and what Steyer thinks he's going to accomplish, unless Steyer really is, you know, very consciously playing the spoiler role so that Sanders can win. But very unlikely that Buttigieg or Warren, Klobuchar doesn't even show up here. So let me ask you this. When you talk about all the different variables, mm-hmm. do events matter? So right now we are in the midst of this massive oppo dump on Bernie Sanders. I mean, all of the vetting that should have taken place a long time ago is taking place in the last 24, 48 hours. Huge controversy Sunday night when he went on 60 Minutes and was praising Castro, you know, despite all the killing and all the camps and all of that stuff and all the boat people and a million people displaced. Hey, literacy rates rose, so he can't be all bad, right? I mean, and that did not play well. He's on CNN last night. He doubles down on that, adding in praise for the Chinese for getting more people out of, you know, the Chi-Coms, getting more people out of poverty than any other country. I mean, this is Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie Sanders, who, you know, would like us to think that when he talks about being a social democrat, it's all about Denmark. But I mean, there's a lot there. So is any of that going to make a difference in South Carolina, or is it already baked in?
The answer is, you know, a little unsatisfying. It's some of both. So what I found building this model is that events do matter. You do have cases where there are sharp breaks, where some news story comes out or some narrative forms in the campaign and somebody suddenly jumps or plummets, and they jump or they plummet outside of, you know, our likely range that we have in the simulator. So that's possible. But the thing is that time matters and volume matters as well. So, you know, in the beginning of the podcast, you talked about all these different events with, you know, Trump and India and coronavirus and so on and so forth. You know, the oppo dump that's happening on Bernie Sanders matters, one, if people hear it, if they can digest it over top of these other things. And, you know, the volume and time are interrelated. Like those stories have to be louder, because there's only so many more days until South Carolina actually votes. If we were, you know, a month or 2 months out of this thing and people were dumping a bunch of opposition research on Sanders, then, you know, it's possible that in that case, the simulator thinks that the swings could be bigger. It estimates a wider range, but really, You kind of have to. It is possible that all these things end up mattering, but sort of the anti-Sanders forces have to get their act together and do, you know, all of their messaging pretty quickly and pretty effectively. I kind of see the debate tonight and then the actual results in South Carolina as sort of the last two pivot points before a lot of the major dynamics of this race get solidified on Super Tuesday.
So you use the phrase "the simulator thinks." You've been spending way too much time with this, you know. Simulator shows, exactly. But you think it doesn't actually. We're not there yet, because I read Andrew Yang's book about artificial intelligence and, you know, and the great displacement that's coming. So when I hear you say that, I get the kind of, you know, the hair on the back of my neck stands up and going, okay, are we going to be replaced by this simulator, which is like reasoning and thinking? And
no, you're totally right. It doesn't think. That's a bad habit I have in my head from spending way too much time coding this thing.
No, but see, I have this image. I got to tell you this. Here's my nightmare scenario, that you're going to be sitting there and it's going to say, "David, we know what's going to happen in South Carolina. David, don't turn it off. This is going to be the result." It's like, what are we going to do? It's like our politics taken over by machines. So speaking of various things, so this two big things, the debate tonight And I've always been, well, that's not true. I'm going to wipe that off here. There's a certain skepticism about whether debates make a difference. I mean, remember, this was Elizabeth Warren's big moment last week, and it went absolutely nowhere. But theoretically, you could have, if everybody ganged up on Bernie, and Bernie behaved badly. Well, of course, we kind of know how Bernie's going to behave. That could make a difference. What we don't know is, you know, what would the effect of a massive Bloomberg negative ad buy be? And again, I don't know that there is such a thing. We're hearing reports that there's a lot of stuff online. I don't know how effective the online attack ads are, but debate and massive dumps would be two. The third is in South Carolina. How important are these endorsements? The Clyburn endorsement.
That's a great question about South Carolina and the Clyburn endorsements. I mean, I'm a little bit tempted to be kind of bearish on the whole endorsement conversation, primarily because of the 2016 Republican primary and the fact that a bunch of people, you know, they didn't endorse one candidate, but, you know, a lot of elected officials were tearing their hair out about Trump and were, you know, saying, don't nominate him. And the voters did it anyways. You know, sometimes the voters do the things that they want to do. On the other hand, you know, Clyburn does have a lot of purchase. He's a, you know, a politician with a long career and a lot of clout in South Carolina. So, you know, that's one where I kind of have a little bit of a split brain on it. In terms of Bloomberg and the ads, one interesting thing. So Bloomberg is getting, I feel like, a lot of, up until the last debate, a lot of pretty positive coverage by a lot of media outlets in terms of, oh, Bloomberg strategy, it's bold and it's new and it's working, you know, and that sort of thing. But if you look in the simulator and the national polls and all these different things, he's dumping all this money in, but he's still kind of in the teens in a lot of places that matter. That's kind of the other sort of contrarian take is, okay, he's spending this enormous amount of money. He's building these unprecedented campaign operations, and he's still getting beat by Bernie Sanders and tying Joe Biden, who had, you know, a pretty rough showing in the first two states and also is not the greatest debater, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's one of these things where we're just in kind of a vague zone with a lot of the sort of external factors that people are trying to process.
So you mentioned before Elizabeth Warren not doing that well in Massachusetts. Tell me what's going on there.
Yeah. So essentially what happens is we have the simulator typically go live if we've got two.
And by the way, that's March 3rd. So it's coming right up.
Yeah. Coming right up. So yeah, we typically have the simulator go live if we have like sufficient polling data. So we're about a week out from Massachusetts. And right now, Warren and Sanders are posting pretty similar numbers in Elizabeth Warren's home state. That's not good. If there's anywhere that you should be able to win without really thinking about it, it's your home state. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, she has a kind of a New England-ish style to her. It's not like she's a person who you look at her and you think like, oh, that's not a politician from Massachusetts. That very much is a politician from Massachusetts, right? Like it's one where Warren should be doing well. But I think Warren's sort of illustrating the paradox of being a consensus candidate, right? Which is that she is someone who, in theory, could be a real, you know, unifying figure for Democrats. If she was the only person who was running, I think a lot of Democrats would be really pretty happy and generally okay with having her as the nominee. But if you're everybody's second choice, that doesn't always work so well. I mean, just ask Marco Rubio, right?
It's funny. I was just thinking of Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio was always that guy who was about to make his move. And I remember reading somebody say, yeah, but name me the one state he's going to win. Mm-hmm. And that was when I remember 4 years ago going, ooh, and that's really where Warren is right now, isn't it? You know, that she may be everybody's second choice, but where is she going to win? Name me the one state.
Right now, she is, you know, right neck and neck in those recent polls in Massachusetts with Sanders. And it almost calls back, you know, the other part of the Rubio campaign, which is getting beat in Florida by Donald Trump, who is a competitor from a, you know, different state with a different style, so on and so forth. But yeah, it's a little bit tough if you can't ever build your base as a consensus candidate, oftentimes you don't get off the ground. I think this was Kamala Harris's problem as well. You could argue it was Marco Rubio's problem. And even in 2012, I've kind of had a little bit of a hot take, which is that maybe the consensus candidate of 2012 was actually like Rick Perry, and that he is the person who had the greatest sort of potential to appeal, but he tripped over himself like a million different times and was not enough of a hardliner on immigration, and someone who was clearly from sort of the moderate wing, who had his foot firmly planted in one part of the party, which is Mitt Romney, actually won. So maybe with these mega fields, that's just what you need to do, is have one foot firmly planted somewhere, get a base, and move from there. I don't know.
Your simulator shows, and again, some of these big states coming up very, very shortly, California and Texas. Sanders leading in California, not a huge surprise there, but interesting in Texas. That looks very close right now. And also, that's a state where Michael Bloomberg is on the ballot.
So Texas is an interesting one because it's the second biggest haul of the Super Tuesday states. And I think what people oftentimes, you know, sort of misunderstand about states like Texas or states like California, people recognize that there is a large Hispanic and Latino population in those states, but those demographics also skew young. There's this real overlap in the Bernie Sanders coalition where, you know, some of the young voters who he appeals to and the, you know, Hispanic / Latino voters that are in the state are the same people. So, you know, people have stereotypes about Texas that, you know, it's a state that's all full of tumbleweed, or it, you know, they have all kinds of different views of Texas. But Bernie Sanders is able to build a base well there. He's going to have maybe some opposition with the sort of Democratic trending suburbs, the people who are not on board for every single progressive idea, but really don't like Donald Trump. He'll face some resistance there. But, you know, Texas and California, if you just compare them to the first four states, they are more similar to Nevada than they are to South Carolina. They're more similar to Nevada than they are to Iowa or to New Hampshire. And we just saw on Saturday, Nevada was a really great state for Sanders. It's a state where he ran away for it, and they called it for him with, like, you know, 6% of precincts reporting or whatever it was.
Yeah, and that was that was stunning. Of course, these are much bigger states. Okay, so here's the most important data point, I think, of 2020 right now, because the theory behind the Bernie Sanders campaign is, leaving aside the ideology, is that he's going to attract this wave of new voters, that he is going to mobilize young people. They will be excited. They will be excited, and disengaged voters who sat home 4 years ago will come out. What are you seeing? I'm looking at the New York Times story from yesterday. Sanders says he'll attract a wave of new voters. It has not happened. Bernie Sanders has so far prevailed by expanding his appeal among traditional Democratic voters, not by driving record turnout. Do you agree with that take?
Yeah, I do agree with that take. And I think there's other pieces of information and data that at least initially bolster it. I mean, after Donald Trump became president, there's the obligatory thing where you say never say never on anything, right?
Right. We all say that.
Right. But at the same time, I think also over at the Upshot at the New York Times, if I remember correctly, there was essentially a study that said, okay, if you keep ratcheting up turnout, you don't just get new Democratic voters.
Exactly.
You also get new voters who would be more prone to Trump, who are sitting out because they believe the process is corrupt, but they process that in a very different way. And that, you know, Bernie Sanders right now, one, isn't necessarily creating that massive wave of turnout as promised. And two, even if he did, it may not pan out exactly the way that he plans. I mean, Sanders is such a wild card. I think he is one of a few candidates who has the ability to sort of, you know, do a populist thing in opposition to Trump's populist thing. It's not, you know, it's not matching populism with being a technocrat. It's like matching with a different type of being a populist, right? So I think there's something there that's interesting and that's a little bit hard to predict with respect to Sanders. He is unlike past Democratic nominees. But I mean, if he gets the nomination and he wins the White House, I think there's probably going to be this divergence where he talks a lot about a revolution of immense turnout and so on and so forth, and where the real story of the demographics and the actual voting looks kind of different from the rhetoric, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And, you know, this is really striking to me because this has almost been conventional wisdom that the Democrats were, well, first of all, we're focused on electability rather than ideological purity, but let's put that aside, but that they were absolutely fired up. And that's what contributed to the blue wave in 2018. But then you look at what's happening this year. Iowa, the turnout for the caucuses was lower than expected. It was up 3% compared with last time. And, but a lot of it was concentrated in the, you know, well-educated areas that was not Bernie country necessarily. In fact, in Iowa, this is the New York Times analysis, in the Iowa precincts where Sanders won, turnout increased by only one percentage point. And there was no sign of any sort of a Sanders voter surge in New Hampshire either. And same thing in Nevada, where this is the New York Times, where the nearly final results indicated the turnout would finish above 2016, but well short of 2008 levels, despite a decade of population growth and a new early voting option that attracted some 75,000 voters. The low numbers are all the more striking given the huge turnout in the midterm elections, which was the highest in a century. So, what do you think's happening here? Is it simply that people, there's in a crowded field, Democrats are sitting home because they're waiting for it to sort out? Or has this big blue wave enthusiasm been overhyped?
It's a good question. It's hard to exactly say, but if I had to think through it, I think a couple things off the top of my head. One is that it's a little bit hard to map primaries directly onto general elections, but that you have a lot of other things competing in the news with politics right now, including politics itself, right? If someone's, you know, just being dialed in and trying to figure out what's going on, it's not Democratic primary all day long. Part of it is, you know, coronavirus, Trump's doing this, Trump's doing that. Whereas in 2018, in that election, at the very least my experience of it, was that there were fewer sort of competing stories, and even the competing stories got wrapped into the election, right? Like Brett Kavanaugh was also a midterm story, right? So I think some of it is that. I wouldn't be surprised if when the general rolls around, you do see a little bit more of the anti-Trump enthusiasm coming back, but that depends in part on who the nominee is. Bernie Sanders is risky to a lot of the new Democratic converts. He's not a safe bet as someone who's going to keep all the swing voters in the basket.
Well, that's the key, because the entire rationale, I think, for his general election candidacy is that he's going to bring all these new folks out, and there's no evidence of that. So, you know, all of the hot takes about, well, the young voters are going to be turning out in absolute droves, have we seen that yet?
I mean, there's a couple narratives that come around every single election, and they don't always bear out in the data. One of them is the, you know, surge in youth turnout and the margin in youth turnout being something that will definitely carry the Democrats to victory. In 2016, that's one of the things that was supposed to happen. And, you know, obviously Hillary Clinton didn't win and that, you know, narrative didn't materialize. Another one is the, you know, sort of overlapping idea that there's going to be a sudden surge in Hispanic and Latino turnout. And maybe there is, you know, history, right? It always isn't until it is, right? Maybe there is, maybe that's going to happen this time. But with Trump on the ballot in 2016, who has said some really, I would say, offensive things about, you know, various Hispanic groups in the country, even with him on the ballot, it wasn't like turnout skyrocketed among Hispanic and Latino voters. That didn't happen in 2016. So projecting these turnout waves and saying, oh, this turnout wave is going to save us, is oftentimes not a great idea. It's, you know, it's good for a campaign to try to turn out new voters. But I think, you know, the best campaigns try to do everything. And if you persuade a voter, that's one less step in the process, right? You're not just convincing a new person to come out and then to vote for you, you're convincing somebody who's already in the habit of voting, who's already sort of trying to figure this whole thing out, that you're the right choice. And in some ways, that's a lower effort lift.
The other interesting poll result that we've seen recently is when they break down support in the general election one-on-one match. I'm trying to you probably remember what the poll was, showing that among college-educated women, all of the Democratic candidates lead Donald Trump by double digits, except for Bernie Sanders, who barely leads. So for all of this talk about how he's going to turn out this massive wave of millennials or younger people, he's looks like he's also going to underperform with one of the demographics that we had spent, it feels like we spent the last 2 years focusing on, college-educated women, the women who really delivered the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives by turning out in big numbers in these suburban swing districts.
Yeah. One thing that sort of got missed prior to the 2018 election is that a lot of Democratic messaging in key districts was something sort of around Donald Trump is bad. We know that you don't like him. We're going to deliver competent governance that focuses on things like healthcare, which is a pretty different, you know, message than, you know, the revolution is coming, right? Like, those are two pretty different things. And what you end up having is Sanders kind of pulling far and making people who really don't like Donald Trump choose between somebody who they are really uncomfortable with ideologically and someone with whom, well, they're also uncomfortable with ideologically and they're uncomfortable with personally. And it puts people in this sort of split position. The suburbanites who voted for George W. Bush and then voted against Donald Trump and then voted against Democrats in 2018. That's what you might call a swing voter, right? That's somebody who goes from party to party and, you know, isn't safe if the Democrats choose to nominate someone who's a Democratic socialist. Now, you know, it's always possible that, I don't know what, there is an economic downturn, that coronavirus causes chaos, and that this is all a moot point anyways, right? And Bernie Sanders sails to it because the economic conditions just allow him to. That's all possible. We need to keep the atmospherics in mind as well for this whole thing. But, you know, there's what, about a week for Democrats to decide if they're doing the Sanders thing or if they're, you know, gonna try something else, and a week for them to figure out if they're gonna coordinate behind somebody else. And then a big piece of the general election is maybe not baked in, but something closer to it.
So you tweeted out this morning that the idea that all of Sanders supporters are locked in is a little confusing. In part because, you know, he went from like 17 to 19 points at the beginning of the year to 27, 29 now. So you're suggesting there's at least like 10 points there that almost by definition is a little bit mushy.
Yeah. So one of my sort of, I guess you could call it a pet theory about the primary that I can't fully substantiate, is that we've got a little bit of a prisoner's dilemma that's also a little fueled by misinformation, right? Mm-hmm. And not misinformation in the sense of like someone's lying or something like that. But Bernie Sanders' support, at least in the world of media, is often talked about as if it is this impenetrable block, right? There's the, you know, Bernie bros and the Sanders enthusiasts, and they are not moving no matter what you do, no matter what you say to them. And that's true of some voters. I mean, the man had a heart attack in the middle of the campaign, and he was still sticking around between 15 to 20% of the vote. That seems pretty significant. He does have some loyalists. But within the last 2 months, he has really gained, you know, a chunk, about 10% in the polls. And the fact that those people weren't there 2 months earlier does mean that a real solid chunk of the Sanders coalition can be peeled off if somebody chooses to attack him and does it effectively and has their attacks amplified loud enough for a long enough period of time. You know, it's not invulnerable. But instead, what you have on the Democratic side is more of a prisoner's dilemma, right? Where all of the people who are to the right of Sanders or more establishment than Sanders, so basically everyone, is in this situation where they believe, correctly or incorrectly, that they're the consensus candidate. They could beat Sanders one-on-one if only everyone else would drop out. And if everybody believes that, nobody drops out and they all split the vote, right? This is a classic thing that appeared in 2016 as well.
It is classic prisoner's dilemma, and it is exactly what happened on the Republican side in 2016. You know, there's this interesting debate among the Democrats. This is sort of a digression. Among folks on the left, particularly in social media, why are we listening to all of these never Trumpers? You should shut up, you know, get your own house in order. This is our house. Of course, we all live in the same country and all of that. You know, a lot of, you know, complaints about MSNBC having, you know, never Trumpers on. Well, one of the reasons why perhaps people ought to listen to those of us that bear the scars is because we bear the scars. We've been through this. We've seen this. Guys, we know what the dynamic was. We understood how it worked with Trump in the way that everybody kept saying, well, this is not going to happen. This is not going to happen. There's obviously there's going to be this lane will fill out. And then suddenly, you know, this candidate will be, you know, last man standing. And before you knew it, there was Donald Trump standing there against Ted Cruz. And people went, screw that. We're going with Trump. It does feel so much like that you have these candidates. You know, you compared, was it Amy Klobuchar? No, you compared, who was Marco Rubio you compared it to?
Oh, Warren.
Warren can be, you could also say the Buttigieg was a little bit, Marco Rubio-esque. And then of course there's Amy Klobuchar who has that Kasich feel about her. She's going to win in Minnesota, right? In theory.
Is she going to win in Minnesota? She's got a pretty good lead there. I would be pretty surprised if she didn't win there. That would be, you know, I mean, she doesn't really have a viable path to the nomination now, but that would, yeah, I think she's going to win in Minnesota. It's pretty hard if you play with the simulator to get her in a position where she's like losing a bunch. There's outside chances, but she's pretty solid there. Yeah.
So going back, and because this is the great thing about podcasts, that I can go back and go, hey, this is what I was going to mention, but I forgot to mention it earlier. We were talking about South Carolina and whether events change things. Do you remember the 2012 South Carolina Republican primary? Now, see, that sounds like these.
Oh yeah, Gingrich. Yeah,
Gingrich, exactly. See, now most people, this would be like, come on, Charlie, what are you doing here? But I knew you would know that. That was one of those moments where you go into South Carolina. They had the debate. One of the networks had run this story about his ex-wife saying that he had, you know, wanted to have an open marriage or something. And everybody's going like, what the heck is this? I mean, this was pre-Trump when stories like that might actually hurt a candidate. Mm-hmm. And the first question out of the box for him, and I think, was it John King? I have this.
Yeah, I don't remember, but yeah, go on.
I don't remember things that happened last week, but I have this random knowledge. Okay, this random knowledge, and I remember, and Gingrich just fired back, and he was on fire, attacking the media, and it was a little bit pre-Trump, you know, basically turning the question into an attack on the media and on fairness, and the crowd went absolutely nuts, and I don't know that Gingrich was expected to win the South Carolina primary before that night. But he not only won, but it was like this massive slingshot around Saturn or something where he won big. And it seemed as if it was, you know, a reaction to that one moment in that one debate. And I'm trying to think of any other moment that was that decisive. So there is a little bit of history in South Carolina of events changing results at the last minute.
There is. I mean, when I'm building the simulator, a lot of the distribution, well, I won't get too into the weeds of it, but a lot of distributions have what people might call fat tails. And what essentially that means is like, you still, in this type of situation, in this type of primary, you have situations where really wild things have a possibility of happening. It's not the most likely thing, but like, do happen. This is not like a regular, orderly process that always, you know, stays within certain bounds and stays within certain lanes and so on and so forth. And the Gingrich surge is one of the reasons for that, is that sometimes you do have a debate that really wildly shakes things up in ways that people didn't anticipate. And with the Gingrich thing, it's interesting because that's a couple sort of events mushed together, right? It's the debate in combination with the election results kind of creating sort of a chain reaction. And that's another interesting part about primaries is that sometimes that sort of thing does go off in sort of a different direction if you have that sort of successive hit by hit thing in place.
Okay, now here's my going back to my selective amnesia here.
All right,
so it was John King in 2012. Here's the New York Times report. Mr. Gingrich delighted much of the audience at the debate with his attack on the moderator, John King of CNN, who began the proceedings by asking the former House Speaker about his ex-wife's allegations that Mr. Gingrich asked to enter into an open marriage. Mr. Gingrich, met the question with cold anger, winning roars of approval from the debate audience as he said through nearly clenched teeth, "I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that." But he ultimately said of his ex-wife Marianne's allegations, reported first on Thursday by ABC News, "The story is false. The new dynamic at play in the campaign was apparent on the stage, which looks starkly different from those of previous debates." Blah, 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 blah. It said, you know, with Mr. Gingrich gaining on the polls against Mr. Romney. Interesting you look back on it. I think that ABC report, which they probably thought was a big bombshell, is completely forgotten. The memories of his performance at the debate, but ultimately that didn't change the dynamics. But I do think that Gingrich's role in laying the groundwork for Trumpism can't be underestimated. When I wrote my book, I don't think I gave enough credit to what Gingrich had done in shaping the modern Republican Party back in the 1990s, but also in this moment, which is to make the media the enemy. And when you're confronted with a terrible personal scandal, rather than apologizing or showing any sort of contrition or concern about it, just turning it into, you know, a fiery weapon of vengeance. And that really, you can sort of imagine a Donald Trump sitting at home watching that going, okay, now that's the approach that I would take to that.
It's an interesting thing. I feel like that, and there's pieces of Trumpism that you can find all through sort of the history of the Republican Party. You can find, you know, some of Trump's ways of speaking about immigration over in Pat Buchanan, right? You can find some of the sort of populist thing where you go right on social issues and, you know, either center or left on fiscal issues, or at least in your rhetoric about it. Even candidates like, you know, Rick Santorum or Mike Huckabee, not that they did the same things with media that Gingrich did, but it's an interesting thing to look sort of retrospectively after seeing Trump. And you can find these pieces of his appeals. You can find people who, okay, figured out the immigration bit, or okay, figured out the bit where you kind of chuck some of the libertarian economics, or figure out the bit where you attack the media relentlessly. And he kind of puts together these pieces, does his own sort of reality TV star media domination thing on top of it. And it chugged along and it worked. It's something that, you know, that I feel like there were Trump is very different than any other, you know, politician we've seen in a long time. But he didn't invent everything himself. He picked and chose and sort of pieced together a set of things that turned into his whole strategy.
And he also became an icon for the cause, because I'm thinking back to 2012, and Ted Cruz did everything possible to get as close to Trump as possible on almost all these issues, on immigration, on being tough. You know, he basically was trying to be the, you know, non-Trump Trump. And yet he wasn't able to take the brand away. I know I'm being imprecise here, but if you really hated the idea of illegal immigration, Trump was your guy because he was the most full-throated, and no other policy decision was, no policy position was going to take that away. And I think Bernie, in a certain way, that if you want revolution, if you want real progressive change, he's the guy. It's almost a way of identity. He's got the flag. And so if they're trying to debate with him on, no, well, you know, my plan for Medicare for all is more practical than your plan for more Medicare for all, that's not necessarily going to derail him.
I would be surprised if that was a line of attack that worked. You know, I forget who put it this way, but, you know, Bernie Sanders is in some ways like casting himself as the OG progressive, right? Like, he is the first, you know, he's been saying all these things for a really long time. He has credibility built up in terms of his different positions. It would be interesting to see people sort of go after him on electability. I do think that's a point where he has legitimate weak spots. It would be also interesting to see what happens if people try out attacks on the parts of his record where sort of his record doesn't fit the image, right? So I'm thinking specifically of gun issues right now.
And that's what Bloomberg's going to go after him on.
Right. Something that kind of attacks his strength rather than just, you know, attack something that's impenetrable about his sort of appeal. But these people only have a week to do this. You know, nobody was trying much for months and months and months. And I mean, for what it's worth, a lot of these Democrats thought that he would be hanging out at 15 and 20% because he was hanging out between 15 and 20% for, you know, the entire year of 2019. And now it's kind of taken everybody by surprise.
Yeah, this is something, you know, Tim Miller wrote this last week. He was about a day ahead of the conventional wisdom, realizing that, guys, this thing is almost over. You don't have time. If you're going to make a difference, you can't wait around. And again, drawing on his experience with Jeb Bush, all the people who said, you know, we'll keep our powder dry until after Super Tuesday, and by the time it, you know, they decided that this was a pretty serious problem, it was already too late and it was done. Of course, the big question we have is how willing are Democrats to push a quote unquote brokered convention, which doesn't mean actually brokered, but I sense the very same dynamic among Democrats that I saw among Republicans, which is at a certain point there becomes a fear of antagonizing the supporters of the leading candidate. And the Bernie bros are very much like some of the Trump supporters. And I, you know, already get a sense among some Democrats that, well, yes, we could possibly come up with a way of denying Bernie Sanders the nomination, but it would be burning down the House because his supporters would be so upset. They would be so angry. They would sit home, which was a lot of what I heard about why Republicans didn't want to push back harder on Trump because they were afraid of what Trump supporters would do. So who knows?
It's an interesting thing. You know, there's this small D Democratic legitimacy concerns as well. You know, Democrats have crafted a primary system that's so proportional and that, you know, has so many things in an effort to try to make a, you know, majority rule system and do all that, do all the small D Democratic stuff. And so, you know, if they then do something that's kind of undemocratic, like give someone else the nomination if Bernie Sanders has a strong plurality, yeah, that could really backfire.
So what are you going to be watching over the next 5 days?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching a couple things. I'm thinking of it kind of in phases. One is I want to know what happens post-debate, obviously, see if there's anything that moves the needle there. The other is I'm kind of watching everything that happens in post-South Carolina, because there's only a couple days of media coverage. So, you know, if Biden wins there or does well there, he's got just a couple days to kind of consolidate the narrative and really persuade people. So I'm going to be looking at my traditional data sources and honestly anything that I can find in that interval, because it's so short and so pivotal. And pretty soon I'm also going to start thinking through Arizona, Florida, Ohio, Illinois. Super Tuesday is the big one, but there's a whole slate of March 18th primaries that are coming up, and we've got kind of a sprint in those 2 weeks, and then the dust settles and it's a long break before the Acela primaries, which is kind of the last big day.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I was thinking that you know, if Joe Biden does win in South Carolina, it provides the opportunity to flip the narrative. And of course, the media always wants to have a new narrative, which is that okay, maybe Joe Biden is making a comeback. Maybe you know, Sanders is not inevitable. It does matter what the margin is. Does a narrow win do that for Biden, or does he have to win surprisingly easily?
This is kind of the through the looking glass part of primaries, because, you know, I can ask, does a small margin do it or does a large margin do it? But in a weird way, like a lot of people in our line of work in the media business kind of decide that through our own framing and coverage, and then provides voters with information. So it's this bizarre feedback loop. My guess, if I'm just, you know, one person looking at the rest of our industry and also looking at how voters have reacted to, you know, these wins and these contests that have happened so far, my guess is that like a 2-point win does not change the narrative. My guess is that a 10-point win could change the narrative, could, you know, eat into some of those new Bloomberg converts, because a lot of them are new converts. from some of the moderates. And that tends to be how I think about it, is that, and then anything between like 5 and 9, that's a vague zone. I don't know how to project that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I keep having flashbacks to Wisconsin, because of course I was here, and a lot of us thought that Wisconsin was the turning point when Trump lost here. We thought we were going to be the firewall of rationality, and instead we turned out to be this little speed bump. So the narrative changed for a few days, and then flip back to where it was. So speaking of scars that we bear, those would be some of them. David Beiler, thank you so much for spending so much time and going so deep on all of this and sharing the simulator with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun. I love to do it.
Yeah, and probably by August, we won't have to have you on. We'll just have the simulator on, right?
You know, by then I'll teach it how to speak. No.
Exactly. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.